Hello, and welcome to Profiles. I'm Owen Johnson. Today we have the opportunity to meet an individual who has played an important part in journalism in the United States for more than four decades. John Carroll has had a distinguished career, starting at the Providence Journal Bulletin. He was a foreign correspondent in Vietnam and the Middle East, a Nieman Fellow. He's directed Pulitzer Prize winners at four different newspapers, three of which he edited, most recently the Los Angeles Times. John, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks.
I'm always a little bit hesitant to start an interview like in the way that I'm going to, but in this case, I think it can't be avoided because you were raised in a journalism family. Your father, after graduating from Marquette, started in Chicago and then very quickly was in London and Paris, Geneva, Madrid, and Moscow. He worked alongside Ernie Pyle in London in 1940. Did he influence your career?
He did. Not directly. He was a very hands-off kind of dad in the sense that he never pushed me to follow in his footsteps. If he had, I probably wouldn't have done it. But I noticed things when I was a kid about the people he hung around with. He used to hang around with other journalists. And I thought after a while that they were really much more interesting than my friend's parents. And their office was more interesting than other offices that I happened to see. You know, there's a lot of joking around, a lot of vital interest in what they were covering. People seemed to approach life with a curiosity and also with a sense of humor. And I think that I thought back then that I wouldn't mind hanging around with this crowd when I became an adult myself. And I think it was more of an appeal, not to do the work, but to hang around with those people.
Did you have a eureka moment when you said, definitely I want to be a journalist?
Yeah, I did. I was a kind of an immature student throughout my academic career, so-called. So when I finished college, I was an English major, and I hadn't worked on the school newspaper. And I needed to do something. And I had one talent that I was noted for at my college, and that was the ability to write a paper at the last minute with a minimum of knowledge. It really used to tick my roommates off that I would get a grade roughly equivalent to theirs, and they'd have been working on theirs for a month, and I would do mine at the last minute. So I thought that was a talent that equated to daily journalism. And so I wrote to 20 newspapers or so, and one of them, the Providence Journal, hired me to work in a rural bureau covering stories as small as dog bites. People get bitten by dogs. We would write the story. And it was the first time, probably in my life, that I'd ever been totally absorbed and engaged by doing something and by achieving something. I think part of it was that I was I was a little insecure because I hadn't been a stellar academic performer. So I really was wondering whether I would ever amount to anything. And then the other thing was that it was interesting. It gave me an excuse to ask questions of people when I was curious about things. And I liked the writing. I liked the polishing and then seeing the craft unfold. The next morning I'd see it in the paper, and often I'd think that was a pretty good job. Sometimes I'd think, gosh, I wish I'd had another crack at that one. But I got absorbed in that effort, and that was the moment when I was hooked.
And you barely get started, and then Uncle Sam called.
Right. I got drafted in 1964, and I was only at the Providence Journal for 11 months before I got taken into the Army. I was drafted and got trained down in Fort Gordon, Georgia, and then was sent to, believe it or not, the Yukon Command. The main reason they were up there was to maintain an infantry brigade that was trained in Arctic warfare. And I was an MP initially, a military policeman, but I managed to get out of that and get to the Post newspaper, which was largely indoor work, which in Alaska is a pretty good thing to have, and was doing that. And I didn't go to Vietnam. at that time. When I got out of the Army, I did go to Vietnam for the Baltimore Sun, and I ran into some of the officers I'd served under in Alaska, and that proved to be very helpful to me.
But that would be – having the military experience would have been different than from, say, people like David Halberstam.
Yeah. I think having the – obviously Halberstam did a truly brilliant job. But I do think that having the military background is very helpful in covering military affairs, and particularly, you know, in a war. You really understand how it works.
You got into trouble in Vietnam with the authorities. Can you fill us in on that?
Sure. In 1968, which was the big year of the war, one of the first things I did in January was go to cover the siege of the base at Khe Sanh. That's K-H-E-S-A-N-H for those who are younger than I am. And this base was surrounded. It was in the most remote corner of Vietnam. And at that time, the president was Lyndon Johnson, and he was saying, this is the decisive battle of the war. This is like what Dien Bien Phu was in the French Indochina War, the point at which we... the enemy is going to try to strike a decisive blow, but we're going to turn it around. And so I covered some of that, was in and out of Khe Sanh a couple of times. It turned out that while Khe Sanh was going on, the entire Tet Offensive exploded. And I think in retrospect, many military people would say that Khe Sanh was actually a feint. It was an effort to draw us into this remote corner of Vietnam. And then, in the meantime, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong attacked 100 or so cities, mostly along the coasts. So after all that was over, which took quite a while to play out, in the summer of that year, I was looking around for something to write about, and I was rattling around the northern part of South Vietnam, and I went back to Khe Sanh, and it was being abandoned. And I thought, this is a real important story. Only 6 months ago, the president of the United States was saying this is the climactic battle of the war and that Khe Sanh was important to us. He said it sits astride the infiltration routes from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. So here it was suddenly worthless to us, and we were throwing it away after having sacrificed a good many lives to keep it. And I wrote the story without permission, which is forbidden. And I did it because I talked with the Marines who were then in charge of Khe Sanh, and they said there's no reason not to write the story because we are encountering the enemy in the hills around here constantly, and they can look and see exactly what you see. And what a person could see at that time was irrefutable evidence that the base is being abandoned. There was, for example, a metal airstrip that they had there made of pieces of metal that hooked together, an entire airstrip. And they were peeling up that metal airstrip and hauling it out in cargo slings suspended from helicopters. And you could see that from a great distance. They were also blowing up bunkers. And you could hear that and see the dust go up, and when they blow these things up, rats would scurry from one end to the next, and that was quite evident. So I was young, I was rash, and I wrote that story without seeking permission because I thought it would probably be denied. And sure enough, the U.S. command took a dim view of this. They took my press credentials away, which meant that I couldn't go to briefings, which was not that big a loss. But the big loss was that your press credentials would get you on helicopters and planes if you wanted to get from one place to another. They gave you the equivalent of full colonel rank. So you could bump anybody off a helicopter or a plane below that rank unless that person had a written order to be on it. You know, I was stricken. I thought, well, I've made a terrible mistake. And then I was afraid that during this abandoning of the base that our troops would be attacked and that I would be left being blamed for having cost lives, and I was really, as I said, stricken by this. Well, it worked out. No one was hurt. Nothing happened, fortunately. And I will tell you, if I had to do over again, I wouldn't have done it. Some people thought I did the right thing. In fact, a noted military commentator of the time, Brigadier General S.L.A. Marshall, wrote a column saying that I loved what he said. He said, Carroll doesn't deserve censure. Carroll deserves a medal for exposing this. And my paper, the Baltimore Sun, took that column and put it on page one, which I appreciated. But the military command took its time in handling my case. They initially said, why don't you come back? I think they said in 30 days, maybe it was 60 days, and we'll see about getting your credentials back. So I did that, and I came back, and then they said, well, we said you'd come back and we could talk about it, but we're not ready to do that. And then I thought, boy, I've got a problem here. And I was afraid my paper would give up on me, and because they were thousands of miles away, and, you know, I hadn't been a reporter that long. I was 26 years old. Fortunately, some other correspondents got upset about the way I was being treated, primarily Gene Roberts, who was editor of, or he was the bureau chief of the New York Times in Saigon. And I'd gotten to know Gene, and he really was offended by this, the way they were treating me. And he rounded up some other prominent correspondents, Washington Post, Newsweek, and some others, and they went out and saw the command, and they agreed to give me my credentials back in another 30 days. So that worked out fine in the end. And it proved to be a good career move, but I have to say that as an older man now, I wouldn't have done it. I think that I was essentially right that there was no military reason for this not to be known, but when you take a chance like that, you are taking a chance with people's lives, and it's always a possibility that there's something you don't know. General Abrams noted at one point in commenting on this case that if it may well be true that the troops in the surrounding hills knew exactly what was going on at Khe Sanh, that the base was being abandoned. But within military bureaucracies, sometimes it takes a while for that to get to the top. And in the case of this, it would get to Hanoi and get sorted out. And we don't really know what they know. And sometimes you get a result you wouldn't expect. So I wouldn't do it again. I think technically I was in the right in some ways. Technically I was in the wrong some ways.
Is this one of those incidents that led the military in the decades following to greatly restrict journalists' access?
I don't think so. I never heard it cited I never heard myself later cited as a bad example. I may have been without knowing it, but I don't think so. I think the tightening of information from the military sprang largely from the idea that the press was instrumental in our losing the Vietnam War, something I don't believe at all. I think that the fact that the war was a bad idea and that we were unable to win it, at best we could produce a stalemate there unless we resorted, say, to nuclear weapons or some extreme measure that would be obliterating large populations. I think that the press was the bearer of bad news, and it was based on press reports of what was happening in Vietnam that there was massive unrest at home that ultimately resulted in a loss of the national will to pursue this cause. And I think a generation of military people largely believed that the press misbehaved in Vietnam and didn't present a balanced picture. I don't agree with that.
Your time at the Baltimore Sun also included service in the Washington, D.C. Bureau at the height of President Richard Nixon's power. What lessons did you learn there?
Nothing beyond the I learned, first of all, that I don't want to be a White House correspondent. I did that for a while, and it was a difficult job to do original work in. You know, Nixon, like President George W. Bush, had a very tight organization. and not much came out of the White House that wasn't intended to come out. In fact, I got on the beat late. I didn't cover the campaign, and reporters who covered the presidential campaign had access to people and had sources who might talk with them. I came in, I'd been overseas, and I came in and after Nixon was elected and didn't have a chance to make sources before they were literally behind locked doors. You know, they were, you couldn't get past security to talk with them. And I was pretty sure that they had a system in which every regular reporter in the White House had somebody who would talk to them, and that was assigned, and it was a coordinated thing. And I had a guy who would return my phone calls every time and would help me a little bit. But I'm pretty sure he was reporting back on what his contacts, and he was responsible for me. And the best stuff that came out of the White House as the Nixon administration started to unravel was not really coming out of the White House. It was coming out of other places, starting with the Washington, D.C. Police Department. And people triangulated on what was going on in the White House. But if you were in that sealed little bubble of White House correspondents, you didn't get much. So the only way to distinguish yourself was by being good at synthesizing what was happening and writing what we'd call analytical pieces that would take several events and you know, you write it for Sunday and it may cause the reader to think a little differently than he or she did before. But as far as really breaking stuff, it was not easy. But, of course, the other lessons that I learned out of the Nixon administrations were the same ones that everybody else did about basically unethical behavior and abuse of power and paranoia in high places and that sort of thing. And I certainly learned an impressive lesson about the press at its best and what it can do for the public.
Let's take a break here. What would you like us to hear from your collection of favorite music?
Well, I'll start with serious music, and then we'll get on to frivolous music. I like Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 2.
We've been listening to a selection of Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 2 played by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Eric Leinsdorf. The soloist was Sviatoslav Richter. Welcome back to Profiles. We're visiting with John Carroll, the former editor of the Los Angeles Times. After the Baltimore Sun, John, you began to do, I guess, what do we call it, newspaper administration when you went to the Philadelphia Inquirer. What led you to change?
I didn't intend to do it, but when I was in the Washington Bureau of the Baltimore Sun, I got a little bored. A friend of mine, who I mentioned earlier from Vietnam, Gene Roberts, had become editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. He had previously been Saigon Bureau Chief of the New York Times and then National Editor of the New York Times. And among the people I knew at the New York Times, many felt he was the strongest editor there. And he called and asked me, would you like to come up here and be an editor? And I thought that it would be an opportunity to fix a badly broken paper and to learn editing from someone who's best in the business. When I say the paper was badly broken, I don't exaggerate. It was so bad that when Gene arrived as editor, the chief investigative reporter was in the penitentiary for extortion. He discovered that he could make more money by digging up dirt and keeping it out of the paper, threatening people with publication. And he was on the payroll of several organizations. It was a shakedown. That was pretty typical of Philadelphia in that time. It was a corrupt city. And some of that corruption had reached into the newsroom of the paper, which is very unusual. Newspaper journalists are often corrupted by their own egos or by their own desire to be to win prizes or whatever, but they really don't tend to be as money-oriented as a lot of other people. And occasionally you'll get a money scandal at a newspaper, but very rarely. And the Enquirer was a mess, but that's how I went there. I went there with really because I thought so highly of Gene, and I didn't really want to be an editor at that point in my life, but I figured this is the best chance I'd ever get to learn how to do it right.
Gene Roberts won some Pulitzer Prizes there with the newspaper that in the newspaper fraternity, I guess, is called the Inky. How did he go about doing that? Was it just people or were there other lessons involved?
Well, there were a lot of lessons involved in how Gene did it. He took that terrible paper and turned it into a place where everybody wanted to work. And I think it exceeded the New York Times and Washington Post in Pulitzer winning at that time. It was a remarkable thing. I'm not sure that those numbers are correct, that they exceeded those papers, but it was, if not, it was hugely competitive with these established papers. And Gene brought a lot of tools to it. He had a great eye for talent, you know, reporting talent and photographic talent and editing talent and so on. And he led in a very idiosyncratic way. He loved stories. He was kind of odd in his approach. He never attended a meeting. I never saw him in meetings. He never attended the daily news meeting and so on. But he kept up with the things he wanted to keep up with, and he did things that were important really well. And he assembled an amazing amount of talent in that paper. And the result of that combination of things was journalism that got recognized for excellence. I should say, though, that part of the paper's success in winning these awards was its good fortune in being situated in one of the most corrupt cities in America. And Philadelphia has long been that type of a city. It goes way back, back to the, you know, the turn of the century and the muckrakers who described it as corrupt and contented and often rated it the worst. And it remained that way. And to this day, it's quite corrupt. That was bad for the citizenry, but good for the journalists. They had a ball exposing this stuff. And some of the corruption was so long established and accepted that it was almost right out in the open. People didn't even know you were supposed to hide it. I remember in one story we discovered that a particular politician had put a number of ghost employees on the state government payroll, people who drew salaries but didn't go to work. And we tracked one of these guys down. He lived in Atlantic City, New Jersey, spent his time at the beach and at the track. We tracked him down, and he expressed indignation at the question we asked about why he should go to work. And he said, look, I've done everything my committeeman ever asked. What's the problem? That was the culture we had in Philadelphia at that time. As I say, it was great for the newspaper.
A little bit different when you move to the newspaper in Lexington, Kentucky, the Herald Leader, which I guess in some ways would be something like Bloomington, Indiana, university town, although we don't raise horses in the Bloomington area. To what degree did you try to bring your Philadelphia experience to Lexington?
Well, I did try to bring it to Lexington. Particularly, we got into investigative reporting, which had not been seen in Lexington before. I also basically tried to imitate Gene Roberts as an editor, although I quickly realized that his style of doing things was uniquely his own, and I was not Gene Roberts, and I had to figure out who I was and speak in my own voice. That was a good educational thing, but I tried to bring the best of the lessons I learned in Philadelphia to Lexington.
How did you find the stories that produced the Pulitzers at Lexington?
The biggest story we did there in terms of public notice, not necessarily the most important story, was an expose of chronic and widespread cheating in the University of Kentucky basketball program. People in Bloomington probably relate to that and understand what that would mean to the public, although it may be even more important in Kentucky than in Indiana, in that there's almost a pathological devotion to the program in Kentucky as a substitute for success in other realms. A lot of people regard that as the one thing in their life that really is important and successful. And it's an amazing phenomenon in Kentucky. And so when we attacked the program, it was regarded as a terrible thing. And the paper was, we were pretty well ostracized. We got a lot of threats. We had a bomb scare that caused us to have to empty out the building. We had a shot fired into the press room. And we had a lot of we had boycotts of circulation and advertising, and then we had an attack by pretty much the entirety of the electronic media, which went on for months. I remember there was one talk show that ran every weeknight, and one of the things they would do was put on players who had been interviewed for the series, and the players would say, "No, I never told the paper that stuff." And we had it all on tape. We had 100 tapes. We didn't have a single quote in the story that was not on tape. But it's a measure of what the pressure was on these players that they, even though they knew we had that information, they still went on the radio and said, "Well, I never said that stuff." And one of the topics one night of the talk show that I remember seemed to stand out from some of the others, the stated topic of the talk show was, "How can we destroy the newspaper?" And they literally had people calling in explaining what the revenue streams were at a newspaper and how you could cut them off one by one and so on. So it was a tough time, but the paper actually really flourished during that period. That wasn't evident if you were up close and you were in the middle of it, but in the course of the 1980s, and this story was published in 85, the paper was wildly prosperous, and it was a good period for newspapers generally, but this paper in particular really flourished in terms of the money it made and in terms of the circulation growth that it had. The lesson being, I think, that people don't buy a newspaper because it tells them things they want to hear. They buy it because it tells them things that are significant and sometimes unpleasant to learn, but you couldn't be part of the conversation in that community without getting the Herald Leader.
I wonder if you'd be able to do a story like that these days, because one of the things to do an investigative story, you have to persuade people to talk. And these days, athletic departments keep very tight control over their athletes and their access to the media.
I think that's true, but I don't think it would be impossible to do a story like that. I don't think, for one thing, I don't think you can corral all these people and keep them from talking if you've got the right reporters approaching them.
There was one other story, major story, that you did there on, I think it was called Cheating the Children.
Yes. That was probably a more significant story than the basketball thing. We decided fairly early on in my editorship that we were going to make education, public education in Kentucky, a subject that we gave extra coverage to, because in my thinking, it was probably the state's biggest problem, the main thing that was holding it back. And the schools were pretty miserable. And we wrote a ton of stories about it and didn't get a whole lot of reaction. And we couldn't quite find the key. And I was beginning to think maybe people here just don't care about this and they're not ever going to care about it. Kentucky's kind of an anti-tax state, and nobody wanted to pay for better schools. And Kentucky, and there's a fairly strong strain of thought in Kentucky that government itself is suspect. And I can't remember the year this was. A lawsuit made its way through the courts, and the state Supreme Court ruled that the Kentucky school system was unconstitutional because it was unequal from one school district to the next. Kentucky had many, many school districts. I don't remember how many. It had 120 counties, and it had more school districts than that. And these were little fiefdoms for local patronage. As somebody said, the biggest issue in most Kentucky school districts is who gets to drive the bus. So instead of writing about the school system as a system, we wrote about it at a local level, and we put a bunch of reporters on it, which we really couldn't afford to do, but we did it anyway. And we discovered the fact that most of these school systems were corrupt, and everybody in town knew they were corrupt. And as long as they were corrupt, who would be willing to throw more money into it? We investigated the property tax system, which is a big source of tax money for the schools, and discovered that in some counties, many people, rich people, didn't even have their houses on the rolls. They just go see the tax assessor. The tax assessor just strikes their house from the rolls. We discovered that the largest building in the state capital, which is Frankfort, was owned by the governor and was not on the tax rolls. And these are the kinds of things that people know about and resent. We discovered that some houses that were very modest houses were on the tax rolls for vastly more money than some of these McMansions you see around. So that was just one example of the reason that people didn't support this corrupt system. So we blew it sky high. And in trying to, and that created a public pressure for the governor, who was resistant to progressive change in the schools and to spending the money that it would take, and in the legislature. And it pretty much steamrolled that issue through the legislature. And they even brought in a consultant from out of state who was a noted authority on school systems, basically to write a reform program. And as I recall, he wrote 50-some new laws that were just passed instantly and caused Kentucky to become a reformist state in education. And the paper was very proud of that. I was as proud of that as anything I ever was involved with at the paper or at any paper. It worked out quite well.
Let's take another break here and listen to some more music. Could you tell us the next selection and why you chose it?
Yeah, I'd like to do the Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles from many years ago. It's one that I used to have on a recording, long misplaced. I always liked it, and it's kind of an upbeat, optimistic piece. So that's what I've chosen.
Welcome back to Profiles. That was music from the Beatle album Abbey Road, Here Comes the Sun. Our guest on Profiles today is John Carroll, who has become something of a cause célèbre for the last 5 years of his journalism career when he was editor of the Los Angeles Times, starting in 2000 and finishing in 2005. Probably the high point of that was in 2004 when the paper won 5 Pulitzer Prizes. What did you think you were going to do when you went to Los Angeles?
You know, I didn't know. I'd been editor of the Baltimore Sun for 9 years, and I'd been editor of the Lexington Herald Leader for almost 12 years before that. And I was thinking, you know, I've really done this newspaper editing thing. I ought to try something else. And I almost took a job up at Harvard running the Nieman Foundation up there, which would have been a nice change of pace. And then along comes this job with the L.A. Times. And the L.A. Times at that point was having a scandal, the so-called Staples scandal, and morale was low and so on. And the new, it had just been bought by the Tribune Company in Chicago, which was a big shock to the people in L.A. who'd been accustomed to local ownership. It really needed a lot of work. It was also a very large paper. It was triple the size of the Sun or even larger than that. And I can remember, first I thought, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to stick with my plan to go up to Harvard, even though I hadn't signed up with them, but I was on the verge of it. And then one day it just struck me, and I used to think that it was a little bit like, you know, being Captain Ahab on the beach and seeing the white whale swim by. You got no choice. You just got to go do it, even though you're not quite sure what the outcome will be. So I went and did it, and when I arrived there, my extension on the phone was 5050, and I told my wife that day, I said, this is good. I'll remember this because 50-50 are my approximate chances of success in this job. But it turned out to be quite wonderful. And the people who were upset and at the way the paper was being run were most welcoming to a new regime and ready to get back to work. And it didn't take any time at all to get things humming in the newsroom, mainly by just back to basics. We're just going to concentrate on the stories we do, and how you feel about it is how you feel about it. But we're going to do these stories, and we're going to do them as best we can, without a lot of attention to anything else. And I think people like that, and things really picked up. So that's how it worked out at the beginning, and it was, as I said, just great from my point of view.
Did you bring in a lot of new people as well?
I did. I felt that the paper was very strong, very muscular in terms of its reporting staff, but it was not as strong in terms of the high-level editors that it had. And pretty soon I realized that I needed some help. And I looked around, and I didn't know the West Coast scene as well as I knew the East Coast. But the West Coast has not produced as many good editors as the East Coast has. I didn't want to import editors from the East, but I ended up doing it. I hired a guy named Dean Baquet to be the managing editor, which is the number two job in the newsroom. He was the national editor of the New York Times. I hired some others from good papers in the East. And we used to laugh about it because all of us, every one of us who went to L.A. from the East became stereotypical Southern Californians. We got convertibles, we got sunglasses, we got hot tubs, and it was like a second childhood. It really was, in addition to being professionally rewarding, it was fun. And they did a great job. And Dean succeeded me as editor, but then he ran afoul of the same problems that I ran afoul of and eventually got fired and is now back at the New York Times as Washington bureau chief.
I think it was Ken Auletta in The New Yorker who wrote that the challenge for you was that as editor, you wanted to spend more time with the journalists than with the higher-ups, because the Los Angeles Times did, in fact, and still does, as we record this interview, belong to the Chicago Tribune.
Well, it wasn't as if I got a lot of invitations to spend time with the corporate higher-ups, but it's true. I really thought it was important for an editor, particularly an editor coming into a newsroom that was troubled, to be there, to be a presence in the newsroom, to do stories, to do journalism, and not to be over on the business side or up at corporate headquarters adding up the beans, because other people can do that.
What does it feel like on that day in the spring of 2004 when the paper won 5 Pulitzer Prizes?
I was startled by it. You know, I'd been on the Pulitzer board for 9 years, but by this time I was off it. And I knew that that number had never been achieved except for the New York Times had 7 the year that New York was attacked by terrorists. But nobody else had ever hit 5. And I kept checking and rechecking to make sure it was actually true. But it was a very happy day. And happy because for the obvious reason, but also because these awards were from all parts of the paper. It wasn't concentrated in any one place, and people in various departments were really doing a great job, and And this was recognition for them. So it was a wonderful day.
Which do you think was the best of the Pulitzers that year?
Gee, I don't know. I'd have to think about that. The most unusual was a guy who'd been on the paper only 5 months named Dan Neal, who won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism, and he is an auto critic. He wrote an auto column. Now, the serious arts critics were very distressed that somebody who writes about cars, some grease monkey, could win a Pulitzer for criticism. But I thought it was just great. He's a very wonderful writer. His column was filled with cultural observations, political observations, and a lot of off-the-wall stuff. You know, he'd base a whole column. He'd review a car, but he would base it on Isaac Newton's theories. I mean, he'd keep coming back to Newton. It was entertaining, and it was something you would never get anywhere else. And I was so happy to see him recognized for that.
It was interesting to read your remarks at an award ceremony where you received the award, the Burton Benjamin Award for Press Freedom from the Committee to Protect Journalists. And reading those remarks, it seems you were expressing great concern about the way things were going at the Times in connection with the Tribune Company. Mm-hmm. How would you characterize the difficulties?
In a broad sense, the marriage between large corporations and local newspapers, which occurred, well, it's been going on a long time, but it really accelerated in the 60s, 70s, 80s. It's had a trajectory. It went up, and when the money was good, everybody got to do pretty much what they wanted to do. But then when the money got tight, and particularly since the Internet has completely scrambled the business model of newspapers, it's gotten uncomfortable on both sides. The journalists are uncomfortable, and the owners, or the corporate management who represent the shareholders, have had a tough time. The principal thing that bothered me was the fact that we were acting as if we still had a quasi-monopoly locally and we could take 20% profits, operating profits, out of the paper each year, which means keeping 20 cents on the dollar before paying taxes. Acting as if we still had a monopoly and could charge whatever we wanted to and do whatever we wanted to. Now, 20% margin is about double what the average is of a Fortune 500 company. So it's not as if my opinion on this is particularly out of line. I felt that the LA Times at a 10% margin could be a dominant force in its market and could really be a juggernaut. But at 20%, it was gasping for air. It was becoming a worse paper. In order to hit 20%, you had to get rid of reporters every year in large numbers. You had to cut down on the space in the paper. And you had to live with all the morale and difficulty that that sort of ongoing retrenchment causes. So I didn't like the financial plan, although I realized that the people at the top of the company are trapped. If they suddenly said, we're going to a 10% margin, they would be fired. They wouldn't have a chance. So to some extent, you've got a doomsday machine running here in which you can't. No one is empowered to run the company on a basis that could be sustained for the long haul. So I didn't like that for obvious reasons. And I also felt that there was a certain cultural pressure from corporate. You know, there's a corporate culture that's a very powerful force. You know, we learned to worship CEOs and we've learned all the jargon of business, get out of your silos and leverage your assets and all these things. You find journalists actually speaking in those foreign tongues too. And the cultural pressure on journalism became, I thought, damaging to it. And it created morale problems and really problems in the sense of people really knowing what we stand for and what we're here for. People at the corporate level actually had contempt for the idea that a newspaper should perform public service. You know, if it doesn't produce a short-term bottom line benefit for the shareholder, it's not something you have any business attempting. So there was and is a lot of tension between the corporate way of looking at things and the journalistic way.
With the internet and with the problems that you've outlined, does that mean newspapers are dinosaurs?
I don't know. I hope not. You know, they still make lots of money. People think it's a dying industry, and perhaps it is, but, you know, the L.A. Times last year had a operating profit of roughly $240 million. That's not a dying company. But if you're taking that kind of profit out, you could kill it. So I guess I think that newspapers – What bothers me about the predicament that newspapers are in now is that it is a new world. The old business model has been pretty well wiped out, and it's important for them to find a new business model and to invest in that model. But newspapers are not investing. They're taking money out. What you have is what a business strategist might call something that resembles a harvest strategy, in which you decide your business has no future, so you're going to milk it for all you can get out of it before it dies. So I don't think there's much stewardship going on in these big corporations. You'd see more stewardship at papers that are family-controlled, such as the New York Times. And Wall Street's very upset at the New York Times for the way they run their business. Washington Post is family-controlled, and the Wall Street Journal is, and all three of those are investing more in the future than other papers, particularly in their web operations. Whether ultimately web operations will pay the bills of the expensive news gathering that newspapers do remains to be seen.
Well, I hope maybe in a few years you can come back and talk to us about that. That brings us to the conclusion of this interview. Our guest was the distinguished journalist and editor, John Carroll. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
We're going to go out with another of John's favorite music selections, Cowboy Man by Lyle Lovett. I'm Owen Johnson, and thank you for listening.
She wore glass slippers. She held her head up high. She had that sparkle, a lot of feet, and that twinkle in her eye. She smiled at me as I wondered why. She said, I'm looking for a cowboy to take me for a ride. And he can rope me on the prairie, and he can ride me on the plain, and I will be his Cinderella if he'll be my cowboy man. She said, I got a 40-gallon Stetson hat with a 38-foot brown. My Cinderella, and I'll be a cowboy.
The program you just heard was recorded in April of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.